Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For 33 years, the Philbrook Indian Annual was one of the top venues and shows for Native American art from 1946 to 1979, and its influence on the course and development of Indian fine art is undeniable. The juried art exhibition drew collectors, curators, and artists from around the world. In fact, the winners of the Philbrook exhibition are featured in many of the world's finest Western art museums. Of course, most are also in the Philbrook collection. The Philbrook exhibition was a bit different in that it featured painting alone for many years, eventually adding sculpture and other media, and also featured only Native American artists as judges. Over the years, the absolute best Indian artists presented works: A.C. Blue Eagle, Dick West, Oscar Howe, Alan Hauser, Fritz Schulder, Al Mamadeh, and Black Bear Bozeman, just to name a few of the award-winning artists that are featured in the Indian Annual over the years, and also in the new exhibit, Impact, the Philbrook Indian Annual, which is now on display at Philbrook through January 11th. My guest today is Christina Burke, the curator for the exhibit, as well as curator of Native American and non-Western art at the museum. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Christina Burke, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on an excellent show, which tells a story. If you're a longtime Tulsan, you probably remember the Philbrook Indian Annual, but for younger Tulsans, this might be a whole new story. Tell us a little bit about the Philbrook Indian Annual. How did it get started?
Well, the Indian Annual started in 1946, so right after World War II. And it was a time of great change, not only in the world and in America, but in the Native American world and Native art world as well. And a lot of Native artists had served in the military and had experiences that their relatives and ancestors hadn't had, and that became reflected in their artwork as well. So times were changing, and Philbrook started this annual competition specifically for Native painting. And it was an exhibition that was hung in the museum galleries. So it was very different than a lot of market shows like in Santa Fe and Gallup, where you have Indian art for sale, but it's one weekend a year and outside, sort of a festival atmosphere. This was really an exhibition in the galleries. And one of the things that set it apart is that the judges for this show were themselves Native artists.
Mm-hmm. And over the next, 33 years, this became one of the biggest events in Native American art here in the country. And you had museums from all around the country and probably around the world coming to buy art along with Philbrook from the annual.
That's right. It wasn't just an exhibition, but all the work was for sale. And again, it was a month-long exhibition. And one of its stated goals was to encourage collecting by both individual collectors as well as curators from Philbrook and beyond.
So one of the goals of this exhibition is to judge its influence and impact. As you're looking back at the annual, when you look at, say, the paintings that you see in 1946 versus the last year of the annual, 1979, what sort of influence do you think Philbrook had on Native American art itself?
I think it had an incredible influence. And one of the reasons is that with this focus specifically on paintings, it gave Native artists a platform to really experiment, explore, and push the boundaries of the definition of what was Native painting.
Was market the market-driven shows less about painting and then about more about the crafts and things like that? Or the more we could call craft, jewelry making, sculpture, pottery, that sort of thing?
I would say so. Markets that still go on in Santa Fe and Gallup and other museum-organized shows, the Heard Museum in Phoenix, for instance, and the Idle George Museum in Indianapolis, again, they're one weekend a year, and they're very inclusive in terms of the kinds of work that's represented. So pottery, basketry, jewelry, as well as paintings. But the Indian Annual was exclusively paintings for the first several years.
Give us a sense of when you think about that impact. Obviously, artists are being exposed to more elements. You know, modern art is occurring. And so a lot of that is atmospheric. But what can you sort of pinpoint that Philbrook might have had an influence on how Native American painting changed over those 30 years or so?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. And one, again, that one of the critical elements was that it was Native artists judging their peers.
How unusual was that?
Very.
Okay. So most of the time it would be art critics from the West Coast, East Coast coming out when you're judging a lot of these market And there were competitions involved with all those markets.
Sure, competitions. Well, yeah. But most of the judges were non-native curators like myself or mm-hmm. collectors, scholars and others. There might be some native artists, but one of the primary focuses of the Indian Annual was that most of the judges were themselves native artists. So whoever won the big awards from the previous year would come back as judges the following year. So people like Alan Hauser, Dick West, Black Bear Bosun, Oscar Howe, Joan Hill, Pablita Velarde.
Now, once they served as judges, would they go back and enter the competition again?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so it was self-perpetuating then.
It would
be like you won and then, okay, I'm going to move to bigger and better things.
This was the biggest and better, yeah. best thing. And so the competition really was quite quite stiff. And people brought their A game to the Philbrook Indian Annual every year.
Well, one of the things as I was looking through the show was the traditional two-dimensional flat figure, how important that motif was, even going on through the 50s and 60s. I would have thought that as this annual went on, that there would be more influences from non-native art. And one of the things your exhibition points out is things change, but very subtly. And that those sorts of imagery and the imagery of ceremony and regalia were very important all the way up towards the end of the annual, like the 1970s.
And still are in native painting. And, you know, the way I describe traditional native painting, it really has two criteria. And one is in terms of the subject matter, images of dances and ceremonies, traditional daily life, hunting scenes, for instance, warfare, but also that style that you mentioned, the flat style, where you have a focus on the figures. And maybe there's not so much emphasis or detail on the background or foreground, but really detail in the figures, what they're wearing, their regalia, et cetera. But that did change and is reflected in the change of the history of the annual and in this particular exhibition.
Yeah, I was thinking of there's a couple pieces, say, around the 1950s, and I'm losing the name now, but all of a sudden you see grass and you see something behind the dancers as they're dancing, and it's all of a sudden there's a foreground and background.
And a sense of perspective as well.
Yeah, yeah. There's an excellent one of a line of Native Americans, like two lines, and you have perspective entering. Was that just something that had never been done before?
Not really. It was, you know, in Western art history, this single point perspective is very important, is talked about a lot in terms of the development or evolution of European and American painting. For Native painters, it wasn't that important until the late 40s, early 50s, and that was the sort of height of the Indian Annual. So people like Joe Herrera, I think that's the painting you're referring to, uh-huh. There's two lines of Pueblo dancers. There's women on the left side and a line of men dancers. And you see this perspective so that the figures who are further at the back are much, much smaller. So you get a sense of depth perspective. And then right in the middle of the painting, there are these two Kasharis, contraries, or ritual clowns of the Pueblo people of the Southwest. And instead of being portrayed in profile, they're looking directly at you. They're engaging the gaze of the viewer.
Now,
and that was also revolutionary at the time.
Really? Well, you know, the first years of the annual, you see, I think, what you would expect to see at that particular time. Again, beautiful, beautiful renditions. But even as early as 1947, you mentioned Black Bear Bosun. He won, this was second place, and it was really interesting in the early days of the annuals. You'd be divided into the region of the country where your tribe came from.
Well, yes, the early years of the annual up through 1959, the only categories were based on region. So it was all paintings. And the three categories were plains, southwest, and woodlands. And actually, your work would be categorized based on the subject of the painting itself and not where you were from.
Oh, okay.
Now, most of the artists painted what they knew. So they painted things from their own tribal and artistic traditions.
But there were some cross-cultural things. I remember an Eastern Indian doing a Southwestern scene, which I thought was really unusual.
In which case, that painting would be put in the Southwestern category.
Yeah.
But yeah, people like Black Bear Bosun with that 1947 painting, it really is influenced by surrealism. And he did that quite a bit early on. There's another piece that he entered into the Indian Annual that's on display at Philbrook downtown as well that is incredibly surrealist. And 1951, Dick West entered a very abstract piece called Water Serpent. which also won an award and is in this exhibition. And this was at a time, again, Native painters were really pushing the boundaries of what was expected in the market, what was expected by curators, what was expected by their collectors.
You know, I'm looking at that piece now, and what was really interesting is you almost have this iconography from modernist architecture. Like, there's this, I think maybe it's maybe a depiction of the Pueblo or something, but it's almost like Frank Lloyd Wright iconography that would be used in his detail work. There's this big giant circle that sort of is behind the buffalo dancer, and it looks like something right out of 50s and 60s modernism.
Absolutely. And people like Black Bear Bosun, Dick West, Oscar Howe, Alan Hauser were being influenced by art movements outside of Native North America. They were pursuing art degrees. Actually, both Dick West and Oscar Howe earned their MFAs at the University of Oklahoma in the late 40s, early 50s.
My guest today is Christina Burke, a curator of Native American and non-Western art and curator for Philbrook Museum's latest show, which looks at the impact of the Philbrook Indian Annual. Impact the Philbrook Indian Annual, which is on display through January 11th. That show went on for 33 years and was really a focal point for Native American art, first only in painting, but later in sculpture and graphic design. And what were the various areas? I mean, about three or four areas, I think, eventually.
Later, three or four areas, but really it's known primarily as a painting show. And it was exclusively paintings from 46 until 1958. 58 was a watershed moment, actually, in Native art. And one reason was, actually the main reason was, that Oscar Howe, who was a Yanktonai Dakota from the Northern Plains, had been working in abstraction for a while, and he entered an abstract piece into the Indian Annual, and it was rejected by the judges that year because it was deemed too contemporary and not Indian enough. And he understandably was furious and wrote a letter to Philbrook basically asking, well, now who was this museum to dictate to Native artists what was Indian art? And the following year, Philbrook added a new category for non-traditional painting, and Oscar Howe won an award and continued to participate. But 59 was also the year that they added a sculpture category in the Indian Annual. And it wasn't until the 70s, actually, that a category for graphics, for prints and drawings, was added.
I'm looking at now at a piece from about 1963, and it really struck my eye. It's called Peyote Mystic. But what I loved about it, and it is this sort of full-on portrait of this warrior or male having this dream, and it's not psychedelic. But the color scheme is sort of reminds me a lot of the pop element. So these artists were definitely influenced by everything going on. You mentioned Dick West and his abstract piece in the 1950s, which is a gorgeous piece, by the way. And I'm also looking at another piece by Alan Hauser, which you have an exhibit downtown. So a lot of Alan Hauser is downtown. But this particular piece, it's 1968. Tell us about this. It's basically the Sacred Rain Arrow, which that's a very common theme, and we see it all the time in our community on our license plates. One of the versions of Sacred Rain Arrow.
Yes, and so I mentioned that sculpture came into the Indian Annual in 1959. It really was a transitional year for Native American art, not just at Philbrook, but around the country. So sculpture started being shown at the Indian Annual in 59, but it wasn't until 1968 that this sculpture by Alan Hauser actually won the Grand Award, or Best of Show. So the annual still was primarily a painting show, but here came Alan Hauser with this incredible sculpture carved out of a single piece of ebony. And as you said, the title is Sacred Rain Arrow, and it's a very stylized piece. It's just the left forearm and face and the right hand of an Apache man who is appears to be sending an arrow up into the heavens. Straight into the heavens. So it's a single piece of ebony, and you can sort of see the natural contours of the material of the wood itself. And the bow and arrow are really just implied in this sculpture. They're not there in wood. You have to sort of imagine them there. And he's using positive and negative space to engage our imagination. And again, a very stylized piece. But as you say, it was 1968.
Yeah. And my first thought when I saw this, you know, because the right, and for those who know the version that's at Gilcrease, that's sort of a upward, but it's not going straight up into the heavens. This is actually 90 degrees straight up. And what you see, because of the implied nature of the bow and arrow, is a fist holding the grip of the bow.
Exactly.
And my first thought was, okay, this is the start of the American Indian movement. This is William Smith and John Carlos at the Mexico City Olympics giving the Black Power salute. To me, it was a symbol of Native American power.
I think it's a very powerful image, and to put it in that historical context, I can't second guess what Alan Hauser was thinking, but he was an innovator and a vanguard in Native art, and incredibly influential not only with his own creativity in paintings and sculpture, but also as a teacher and instructor at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, which opened in 1962, and he was one of the very first instructors there, and he taught there for decades. So thinking about 68, so the Institute of American Indian Arts had been open for about 6 years. The first sort of couple of classes of students had come through, thinking about the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, and the Native rights movement and what was happening at the time. I think he was making a political statement.
Yeah, it's a very, very strong piece. And obviously it struck everybody that way because it won the grand prize that year.
And again, was the first sculpture ever to win the grand prize at an Indian annual.
One of the things I was surprised about as I looked at the exhibit, I think I expected more depictions of Indians living their contemporary life. And what you see is that power of the ceremony is very important in the artwork. But there are a couple of examples. I'm thinking of Patrick Desjarlais,
yes, who is Anishinaabe from upstate Minnesota.
And he depicts Indians making wild rice. Very, at first glance, you would say Diego Rivera. You know,
absolutely.
It has that Diego Rivera look. There was also another piece from the late 70s or mid-70s by Ruthie Blaylock-Jones of Shawnees playing dice. Was that not happening yet in Native American art, the idea of showing Native Americans in their own element, sort of living their life? Or was that just not the focus for the annual?
You know, I think there are two factors. One is what Native artists were painting, but also what the market was expecting. And that's true of any artists. And like writers and artists all over the world and throughout time, people paint and write about what they know. So the Patrick Desjarlais piece, which is from the late 40s, making wild rice, the style, as you mentioned, is very social realism a la Diego Rivera, whereas Rivera was depicting sort of the common Mexican worker in the urban environment. That's what he knew. Desjarlais was depicting Anishinaabe people processing wild rice because that's what he knew in his community. And then Ruthie's piece, Shawnees playing dice, that's her family, you know, family game night on the living room floor. You can see the flocked wallpaper in the background and, you know, the families gathered around just enjoying each other's company. She was painting what she knew.
Yeah. What also becomes evident is you can, over the years, there's a few artists where you see maybe an image from, say, the 50s and then another one from the 60s or the 70s, and you can see how their art is evolving. One example of that is Joan Hill, where one piece is this wonderful group of Indian men, Southwestern men, it looks like. You know, they're wearing the straight brim with the tall 10-gallon hats, but on this absolutely stark white background. And it's just very striking image. And then another image a little later, and it's a total abstract.
Joan Hill's a very versatile artist, and so I included a couple of pieces of hers in the exhibition for two reasons. One, to show her versatility, but also to highlight that the Indian Annual was a forum for Native women artists as well as Native men, and one of the few places where women painters could show their work and get recognized for their innovations. People like Joan Hill, Pablo de Velarde, Helen Hardin, and others, Ruthie. The Joan Hill piece that you mentioned with the figures is called Wars and Rumors of Wars, and I talked a little bit about traditional Native painting and, let's say, battle scenes. And this sort of turns that expectation of battle scenes on its head. This is before a battle takes place, and a council of men is discussing this very serious issue of whether or not their community is going to go to war. This is a huge investment of time, energy, and lives that could be lost. And so it's a very somber piece with a narrow color palette, as you say, a stark white background, and these somber-looking figures in browns and dark reds, and they're talking about this incredibly serious issue. The other piece is more abstract and relates to a Southeastern myth about Sabia crystals and their power to help people find things that are lost and to gain power in looking for everything from animals on the hunt to enemies in warfare or success in finding a partner in marriage.
Mm. Now, it's interesting. The abstract comes before the image of the war council, and that's 71. I have to wonder if there's a political element in that as well.
Interesting. I don't know.
Yeah. As the Indian Annual continues, you begin to see never abstract expressionism, but certainly some abstract elements. But then when figurative work comes back in, this is something that it seems like Native American artists grab to, and especially pop art. And in the late 70s, I'm looking at a piece by Delmar Boney. It's called I-40 Viva Gallup, New Mexico. Of course, Gallup, New Mexico, the market there is a major draw. And again, this is just straight pop imagery.
I think it is pop imagery, and both in terms of the color palette and the very stark graphic design that it portrays.
Yeah, and then there's another piece from 74, which was a grand prize winner by Alfred Whiteman. And this is a ceremonial piece, but it is, well, I don't know, this may more reflect on sort of psychedelia in a way.
It could, and it's some of the imagery at the sort of the bottom of the piece really relates to Native American church and peyote religion. Mm-hmm. So there might be some psychedelia coming in there. And then the primary image at the center of that piece, that star sort of exploding
right.
out
mm-hmm.
with these...
That's
these,
a traditional image.
It is, and you see it sewn onto what are known as star quilts, which are objects of prestige and status to this day, given away at various ceremonies and social events as well. That's one of the few pieces that we actually borrowed that's not in the Philbrook collection. We borrowed that from the Heard Museum in Phoenix. Mm-hmm. And the Alan Hauser sculpture that we were talking about was borrowed from the Hauser Foundation in Santa Fe. But all the other pieces are actually from Philbrook's permanent collection.
And Philbrook was a major buyer at this, I would think.
Absolutely, yes. For the first several years, we bought all the award-winning pieces, and then curators from other museums sort of
so
understood
this.
So did
the competition become fierce for the winners by, say, the late 60s and early 70s?
It did become quite fierce, and curators from the Denver Art Museum, from the Heard in Phoenix, from the Museum of the American Indian in New York, which is now part of the Smithsonian, mm-hmm. The New York State Museum in Albany, I mean, just curators literally from all over. Would come sometimes as judges, but also as buyers.
So what happened to the annual? It ended in 79. Was it a matter of it didn't need to be there anymore because this art market was established, or what exactly?
I think that's the short answer, yes. It sort of set up its own obsolescence. When it began in 46, there were no other shows like this. And what the annual did was to literally put Native paintings on par with European and American paintings in a juried competition in the museum galleries.
So there were no galleries where you could go look at Native American painting, or very few galleries. And all of a sudden, by the end of the annual, there are?
Exactly. And museums were taking note as well. Again, curators from all over the country would come to purchase pieces for their permanent collections for their institutions. Private collectors collected en masse. And now we see major collections that were initially purchased by individuals have since been donated to museums. The Silberman Collection at the Cowboy Hall of Fame, for instance. Mm-hmm. Jim Bilak's collection at the Fred Jones at OU. Bill Wiggins' collection at the University of Arkansas in Little Rock. So individual collectors then, you know, purchased over the years and have since given their collections to museums. But also you see, again, in the 1960s, the establishment of the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe. And so Native artists had their own school where people like Alan Hauser, Charles Lolema, Fritz Scholder and others to teach Native students, and the gallery scene in Santa Fe really grew up around that establishment of the school as well.
Yeah. I want to mention one other area that I found really interesting was there was a couple of pieces in the late 70s, Navajo Women in Blankets, where you start seeing multimedia show up and graphic design too. I'm thinking of The Spirit Bird by Dennis Timmons. He's using actual feathers along with his paint. And then there's this wonderful pencil drawing of an owl that is just amazing. Just a wonderful, it's just very simple pencil drawing, but it's just incredibly detailed and a beautiful depiction.
So by the 70s, you know, Native art was changing and the Indian annual was changing as well. So graphics came in, I think, in 1973, if I'm remembering all my dates correctly. And so, you know, the Indian annual, the history of it between 46 and 79, you really see a reflection of the development of Native fine arts in the U.S. With the pushing of boundaries of painting styles, of abstraction, of social realism and surrealism, as well as, you know, recognition that sculpture and the graphic arts were major forces as well.
Yeah. The name of the exhibit is Impact, the Philbrook Indian Annual. It's on display through January 11th at Philbrook Museum. My guest today is Christina Burke, the curator of Native American and non-Western art. And there's that will be on display through the holidays through the beginning of January. But another show that you've been involved with, the Alan Hauser Show at Philbrook Downtown, has only got 1 week left, right?
That's correct.
And this continues to be the centennial year of Hauser, right?
That's right. That's right. So institutions, museums, historical societies, et cetera, throughout Oklahoma this year, 2014, are celebrating the centennial of the birth of Alan Hauser. So he was born in 1914, just outside Fort Supply, I believe, in southwestern Oklahoma. And he was the first Apache child born after the tribe had been released of being prisoners of war for 27 years.
Yeah. And we should also mention, you were talking about how big collections have been growing. Philbrook just received a nice collection of Hopi figures, I believe.
The collection is primarily katsinas, or more commonly known as kachinas.
Right.
From the Hopi tribe of northern Arizona. There's also some basketry as well as some paintings and prints. And it's a major collection that is coming to Philbrook. Actually, I'm working on the first exhibition, which will open at Philbrook Downtown in March of next year.
All right. Well, we wish you great success with that and hope a lot of people come out to see the impact of the Philbrook Indian Annual, which will be on display through January 11th. Christina Burke, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Christina Burke is the curator of Native American and non-Western art at Philbrook Museum. Impact, the Philbrook Indian Annual, is on display now at the museum through January 11th. Another Burke-curated exhibit, Alan Hauser, a celebration devoted to the artwork of the Oklahoma Apache artist, closes this Sunday at Philbrook Downtown. For more information on both exhibits, visit philbrook.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.